Hey everyone, and welcome to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. I'm Mike White. Well, I think one of the best ways to try and work to end the California drought is to go camping in a leaky tent with a four-year-old. We did that this past weekend in incredible thunderstorms, massive lightning. And yeah, you know, like a 1970s tent from your wife's childhood might not be the best piece of gear for that particular trip. On to the interview. Today's guest is Chris Field from the Carnegie Institute for Global Ecology and Stanford University. Chris has got to be one of the best known global climate scientists or ecophysiologists. The range of his activities is so broad that it's sort of hard to figure out what you should even call him. My own background was at the University of Montana, where we primarily did a lot of remote sensing and large area modeling. And so I was sort of in the periphery of what Chris was working on, and it's just been interesting to have this conversation about some of the topics that I used to work on when I was an academic and in grad school, and to get Chris's perspective on those. One thing that really stood out for me is that he has this amazing level of knowledge at a very detailed level on both the cellular and leaf level physiology and ecophysiology, but also the really impressive conceptual insights that are required to bring that leaf level knowledge up to the global scale. And he's famous for having done that now for decades. Of course, Chris was also the co-chair of the IPCC Working Group 2, which was the impacts chapter of the fifth assessment report. And at least partially through his activities there, Chris has also gotten interested and involved in a lot of work on economics and sociology. And we talked for quite a bit about how the global energy system is going to need to transition to a lower reliance on fossil fuels and how energy companies can actually be a big player in that, as well as trying to spark innovation and changing the systems of incentives and subsidies that are now propping up a lot of fossil fuel consumption. So with that, on to the interview. I hope you enjoy. And as always, the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guests. Chris Field of the Carnegie Institute and Stanford University, thanks very much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Michael.
When I was first in grad school in Montana, Lars Pierce was finishing up his work with Steve Running and then came to work with you for a couple of years. And I remember Lars telling me at the time that he was amazed by your ability to kind of build anything that you wanted to build in terms of instrumentation. And you had this amazing facility for construction and intuitively understanding instrumentation. Was that a long-term skill of yours? Were you a tinkerer and a builder when you were a boy?
I've always loved building stuff. And I also tend to think of instruments as kind of halfway between a technical thing and an art thing. And I've always been interested in trying to have scientific instruments that were beautiful and fun to work with, as well as functional and accurate.
What are some of the early things that you built?
In science, I really started out trying to have methods for measuring plant physiology with what we were striving for as handheld instruments. And I know people laugh now when they see what we call the handheld instrument, which was basically enough stuff to fill up a minivan. But before that, measuring the process of photosynthesis required like a semi-truck full of stuff. And in the late 1970s, we really figured out how we could compress that down into a few boxes, and it still took a compressed gas cylinder and some other things so that it was portable, but in four or five trips. And we were able to make measurements of plants that were growing in remote locations under very accurate conditions, but real conditions. And it was a lot of fun to take techniques that had been used either in the laboratory or where you could drive up to with a semi-truck, and then shift them into remote areas where you could either hike with the equipment or you could project yourself into distant tropical rainforests and really kind of expand the universe of the measurements that were within the realm of possibility.
So in those early days, working with these semi-sized instrumentations, were you actually traveling with them to remote locations in that size, or is that down the road?
Well, I'm extremely fortunate to do my PhD at Stanford and Carnegie, where the most sophisticated work in developing the semi-truck size instruments had occurred. And I was inspired by the work they had done to, more or less at the time I started, start thinking about the transition to a next generation of more portable instruments. And so I had a few opportunities to work with the semi-truck size instruments, but did most of my thesis work with tinkering about a new generation of much smaller instruments that we called portable at that stage.
Were those some version of infrared gas analyzers, or was it even before that?
They were infrared gas analyzers, that the technique for measuring CO2 concentrations based on infrared absorption goes back to the 1940s, and that technique is commercially available, and over the years you've been able to buy smaller and smaller ones. Most of my work on equipment has been not so much at the scale of building an individual sensor for something like CO2, but putting sensors together into systems. And for most of the things we want to measure in ecology or in physiology, what you really need is a comprehensive system of things to control gas flows and pressures and temperatures and humidity. At the same time, you're making accurate measurements of things like CO2 concentration and temperature and water vapor concentration. So more than anything else, the kinds of work I did was like plumbing, rather than like designing basic new instruments. In fact, if I had a different career, I probably would have been a plumber.
In terms of the philosophy of science and how ideas are developed, I think sometimes about how you have the simultaneous development of ideas and instrumentation, and that they have to proceed in tandem. And one thing that surprised me is the degree to which the instrumentation manufacturers are responding to the demands from the scientific community, that they're not just feeding out what they perceive as being useful instrumentation. And in your own mind, when you think back about the history of the work that you've done, have your ideas been the driving force of the instrumentation, or have major ideas or conceptual advances in the field been made possible by the developments in instrumentation that are coming externally from the instrumentation and the engineering community?
In my area, which I would characterize as physiological ecology or ecosystem physiology, most of the advances have really been driven by pressure from the scientists. And the scientists have worked consistently to fit instruments together into systems, or to modify instruments to get the level of accuracy or end-to-end measurements that were necessary. A really good example is that carbon dioxide analyzers were mostly set up to measure high concentrations that might be dangerous to humans. And of course, when you're trying to make measurements of plant physiology, you want to measure concentrations in the 300 part per million range, which are normal atmospheric, and you'd like very high accuracy on that. And we were always sort of struggling to try and change the range over which the instruments worked, or to increase the sensitivity, or to find ways to get the manufacturers to do something a little different than they had been doing in order to suit the instruments for a new application. I can remember my colleague at Carnegie, Ola Bjorkman, getting so frustrated that the only available CO2 analyzer was for these super low concentrations for this measurement that he wanted to make, that he was actually out there with a hacksaw sawing the measurement tube in half so that it would be only half as sensitive as the version that was manufactured.
You've also worked with colleagues who have been quite active in hyperspectral remote sensing. I'm thinking about Greg Asner and his work in the Amazon and the Carnegie Observatory. Has your interest in that style of work grown out of the physiological work, trying to find a way to observe some of those related processes from a somewhat broader scale?
My history as a scientist has been very much along the lines of scaling measurements, trying to figure out what processes allow us to scale, which ones don't, where there's information and where there isn't. I've had wonderful interactions with people who do remote sensing work all the way from the start of my career, where I was working with Jim Tucker and Piers Sellers, to the current day, where I have Greg Asner as a colleague. And throughout that period, we've tried to say, well, what can you get from remote sensing measurements, and how can you fit that into a framing where you actually get information that's relevant to the factors that scale? And in the early days, we were just looking at these greenness indices, which are pretty limited. But with the intellectual contributions that Greg has made, we're now able to see a rich set of information about physiological characteristics, about species identity, and we're really able to do detailed analyses of ecosystems that, up to the continental scale, of building on well-established scaling principles. It's been incredibly exciting for me to see the progress in this high fidelity remote sensing that Greg has been the total leader on. And I feel like it's validated a lot of the ideas that I was struggling with without making too much progress early on, when the remote sensing information simply didn't have the information content to let us draw the conclusions that we wanted to draw.
One of the books that made a big impression on me when I was first in grad school was the book that you co-edited with Jim Elringer, which was on scaling processes from leaf to globe. And if I look back over the many, many papers that you've done, you have dual threads of research looking at the very, very fine scale leaf level processes. You begin working on a lot of papers on leaf age back in the 1970s. And then working with a vast array of collaborators on these broader scaling issues, trying to draw those processes up from that level up to the global level. But you haven't at all, as you've gone to the global level, stopped working on these very, very small scale processes. In fact, I think your most recent paper in 2015 was on an invasive thistle and some of the physiology on that. Can you talk a little bit about how you've managed to develop and maintain this interest in these very fine scale processes while still gaining the broader expertise and interest and capabilities in the global ecology?
Back in the middle of the 1990s, I started trying to figure out what for me was the most compelling pathway to think about developing the science of understanding emergent properties at the global scale. What are the consequences of the way the ecosystems interact with the atmosphere, the ocean? What are the unique features that you can only understand when you take a very large scale or global scale perspective? And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that the global scale skills were important, but so were the individual scale skills. And I realized that a real feeling for the way individuals work, biochemistry works, physiology works, are absolutely critical for global scale scientists to have the perspective to figure out what it is they want to study and what they want to build into the scaling algorithms. And so for me personally and for the Department of Global Ecology, I see a sophisticated feel for individual organisms as being the foundation on which we think about the global scale issues.
You tend to have people who are working on the fine scale processes, and you tend to have people who are, or you may have some people working on the global scale processes who feel that the reductionist tendencies of some of their colleagues are not a fruitful avenue of investigation. And I'm just wondering, do you sense any tension in the field on that? And do you see your own role as trying to bring those communities together?
You know, I wouldn't say that it's so much a question of tension as differences in personality. And I think that there are some people who really thrive on understanding more and more of the details and digging more deeply in a direction of more reductionist explanations. And there are other people who feel like the really exciting frontiers of the science are in the more integrative direction. And I think that the challenge and the opportunity is to really celebrate both of those approaches to expanding knowledge. And I think in some cases we have seen that there are actual complementarities between a more and more reductionist approach and a more and more expansive integrative approach. I think one of the areas where we've seen that is in trying to understand the implications of the relationship between leaf nitrogen and photosynthesis. We see the pattern very clearly going across scales, but until we understood the details of the biochemistry of how leaf nitrogen is involved in regulating the photosynthesis process, it wasn't really possible to have a confident mechanistically based explanation for what we were seeing in the large scale data. And I think there's time after time where until you get the biophysical or the physiological or biochemical details in place, you really can't have confidence in what you should be scaling or what the implications of the scaling are.
So this is the idea that leaf nitrogen and leaf nitrogen investments in Rubisco or photosynthetic enzymes and apparatus are a critical determinant of the plant's photosynthetic capacity. Is that what you're referring to there?
Right. And that we know now that for determining the ability of a leaf to do photosynthesis, the allocation of nitrogen not only to Rubisco, the primary CO2 fixing enzyme, but to other components of the leaf biochemistry is really critical. And we know a lot about the way that gets regulated to produce a relatively consistent, at least an understandable relationship between the total amount of nitrogen in the leaf and the ability to do photosynthesis.
So in this particular case, bringing this knowledge from the leaf level up to the globe has encountered, I think, several major challenges. One of them is trying to develop a robust remote sensing approach to get global coverage of this. And I know that Greg and other hyperspectral remote sensors have been working on this topic, trying to use hyperspectral remote sensing to get leaf nitrogen on broader scales. But getting it globally over time and getting the seasonal dynamics, I think, remains a challenge. And then the second factor that seems to have been a challenge is just the understanding in the modeling community of how differences in nitrogen fertilization from industrial activity may be increasing and how that increased deposition of nitrogen could be affecting over the long term the ability of plants to incorporate the higher levels of CO2 into biomass, potentially into higher levels of carbon sequestration. Can you talk about your own perception of where the community is on the net effects of increased nitrogen deposition or nitrogen limitations on global plant productivity?
Yeah. Well, the core question of what it is that controls CO2 uptake at the global scale has been one of the defining questions in my career. And I have continued to return to the idea that evolution has done a masterful job of crafting plants to be efficient in their allocation of resources. And what we find is that there are lots of examples where that works with some precision and lots of examples where it doesn't. But it still turns out that framing from a perspective where we acknowledge the importance of physiological constraints and the importance of ecological tuning in order to come up with testable hypotheses about the way that the system scales. And we understand that as CO2 concentrations increase, the potential for doing photosynthesis increases. But in order for the plants to take advantage of that increased photosynthesis with increased growth, they have to have a number of other resources, including mineral nutrients like nitrogen. But if they have additional nitrogen as a consequence of industrial deposition, they may have the potential to utilize the CO2 even more effectively. And trying to understand the mapping of where extra nitrogen is available, where that contributes to extra photosynthesis and extra growth, and where it doesn't, it's been one of the big challenges, especially because the progress in accurate remote sensing approaches to understanding ecosystem nitrogen is still coming together, even though there's been dramatic progress. We also have a very dynamic understanding of where nitrogen's limiting and where it's not. And I think that one of the things that surprised me recently is the consistent pointers that we're seeing much of the CO2 fertilization that's occurring in the tropics where we know light's limiting. Generally, nitrogen is not all that limiting. And I think that it's been surprising that much of the strengthening of CO2 sinks appears to be occurring in places where we're not seeing lots of nitrogen deposition, but where the overall nutrient economy is consistent with additional plant growth. Of course, the tropics are incredibly complicated to integrate because we're not only looking at changes in photosynthesis, but changes in land use, changes in natural disturbances, and big changes in aspects of climate other than just the CO2 concentration.
And that's also the part of the world where we have the poorest ability, I think, to use
the traditional kinds of remote sensing that you mentioned earlier, these sort of simple band-based indices to try and pick out what's going on over the long term. And but those are the only data sets we have for going back into the early 1980s, for example. So in the tropics, if the evidence from remote sensing is uncertain, and I think that the literature suggests that it probably is, at least for the past couple of decades, are you looking mostly at inverse CO2 analyses and models and based on the flask observations, or are there other robust lines of evidence to reveal this?
When we talk about where the CO2 sinks are.
Yeah, in the tropics.
Right. So most of the evidence either comes from measurements based on the atmosphere, where we're inferring fluxes from the CO2 concentrations. And in some cases, it honestly comes from solving for all of the places where we have good calculations and estimating the tropics a little bit as a residual. Increasingly, what we're finding is we can kind of surround the problem with five or six different approaches and use that to develop a higher level of confidence that we're actually looking at the things we think we're looking at.
And that approach, you're saying that even if you can't measure the phenomenon of interest itself, you can surround it, as you mentioned, with other lines of evidence, and then as a residual, come up with a better answer than you could by direct observations.
Well, I think that in the tropics in particular, we have the ability increasingly to make direct measurements based on the inverse calculations. We have some ability to make direct measurements based on inventories at the local scale. We have an increasing pool of information from aircraft and satellite data that are sketchy, but still allow us to put together a systematic evaluations, especially the new data from the Carnegie Airborne Observatory lets us be much more systematic than we had been able to in the past. And ongoing work is letting us connect that more robustly with the long-term satellite records. So when I talk about surrounding the problem, there's some eddy flux measurements, there are aircraft measurements, there are inventory measurements, there are inverse measurements, and there are residual measurements. So at least five kinds of approaches that give us the ability to make an estimate. And by figuring out where they agree and where they disagree, we can fine-tune and continually tweak the knobs until we're as confident as we can be that we're looking at the right numbers.
Going back to earlier in your career, if you try to trace back your interest in working from leaf to globe on these topics, did it come from working with people like Joe Barry and Hal Mooney that were present earlier in your career? Or was this an interest of yours that preceded working in Carnegie, going back to your days at Harvard and your undergraduate work?
You know, one of the things that's exciting about being a scientist, becoming a scientist, is that you kind of work in a soup of shared ideas. And certainly many of the initial realizations that there were important problems to solve at the global scale came from colleagues. You know, back in the early 1980s, Hal Mooney was very involved in an organization called SCOPE, Scientific Committee on Problems in the Environment, which tried to look at over-the-horizon issues and try and figure out what the policy and world community was going to be asking for in 10 years in the future. Incredibly inspirational figure and was working from the time I met him with the real leading thinkers. Certainly other colleagues like Peter Vitusik and Pam Mattson were beginning to think about the global budget of trace gases. Joe Barry's always been an amazing integrator throughout his career. I think that I was fortunate to kind of work in a cauldron where a bunch of these ideas were bubbling. I hope I contributed some of my own. And I think that we all together had a dynamic that expanded to include people around the world. Inez Fung, who's now at UC Berkeley, Pierce Sellers, who was at the Goddard Space Flight Institute. I mean, we basically had, you could think about it as an expanding cloud of bubbling ideas that really built a community as well as a pool of expertise.
Talking about this pool of collaborators, I was going through your publications and you mentioned some of these names, but I was just kind of amazed by the number of people that you've worked with. And this is just sort of a short list of those people, but Hal Mooney, Joe Barry, Fakhri Bazaz, Jim Elringer, Stuart Chapin, Peter Vitusik, Joseph Anuela, Susan Newston, Jonathan Kutzbach, Pierre Sellers, Ricardo Valentini, Martin Caldwell, Mike Goulden, Rob Jackson, Yichi Luo, Sue Trumbore, Susan Solomon, Mike Ropak, Dennis Baldacci, Jerry Melillo, David LaBelle, Compton Tucker, who you mentioned, Steve Pakala, Colin Prentice, Pep Cannadel, Peter Tons, Peter Reich, Ronnie Avisar, Phillips, yes, Scott Denning, Ines Fung, Ruth DeVries, Jim Anderson, John Gammon, and some of the names that I've kind of come up with as being longtime collaborators. How does this kind of ecosystem of collaboration evolve for you? Is it just that you're here in California and that there's so many people that are in the neighborhood, or does it evolve through international meetings, or how are you seeking these people out, or are they coming to you, or is it all just sort of impossible to figure out how it happens?
Well, I think that good ideas often get nurtured by effective collaborations. And I think that the best scientists often recognize the importance of really going out and nurturing collaborations. It's certainly something that I've tried to do. And I'll mention just a couple of vehicles that have been incredibly important for me. So I think international scientific organizations like IGBP, SCOPE, the Global Carbon Project have been really, really important. Some kinds of funding mechanisms that have tried to bring people together have also been very effective, like the EOS Interdisciplinary Science projects that were developed by NASA starting around 1990 were incredibly important. And many of the core components on which my global scale work has been built really had their seeds planted during these EOS days. And it's also been important that there were, you know, key influential individuals who kind of had a influence that went far beyond their immediate orbit and sort of attracted other luminaries into it. And I think that Hal Mooney and Joe Barry are definitely in that category. And then the other thing that's really important is to keep associations with brilliant students and postdocs. And many of my most exciting long-term collaborators were people who kind of got their start here. And as they found their own wings and really opened up new areas, it's been exciting for me to watch and to continue to benefit from the way they've thought about hard problems.
You mentioned the importance of innovative funding models. I had a friend who moved from a traditional university out to Stanford. And when he got out here, was very interested and kind of blown away by the degree to which at least some of the funding opportunities at Stanford are through foundations. And obviously Carnegie has foundation support. You yourself have experience working at the University of Utah, I think back in the 1990s, for you were briefly there as a professor before coming back to California. Can you comment on the kind of work that tends to come out of foundations that doesn't come out as readily from traditional funding mechanisms like NASA and NSF?
Yeah, I was at University of Utah in the early 1980s.
Only off by a decade, right?
Yeah, I had a great time there, and I really enjoyed the time I spent. You know, I think that science works best when there's a recognition that a variety of different approaches are all worth trying. At Carnegie, our core emphasis is on identifying unusual individuals and making long-term investments and seeing what they can come up with. Basically, starting from the individual and saying, let's exercise your core abilities to see what you can do. I think when you go to the other extreme of, you know, most of the federal grants are really based on the description of the project, and whether the person is unusual or not is much less important than whether the pieces of a compelling project are put together. And what I see is that in most of the private foundations, it's somewhere in between. You know, that there's a trust in the people, a trust in the ideas, a trust in the institution in order to create an environment in which good things can happen. Personally, I think it's critical that we nurture all of those pathways in science. The Carnegie approach of long-term commitments to individual investigators has been dramatically successful. We definitely want to make sure we maintain that one. Projects are really important. Projects are especially important if you need to assemble large groups of collaborators, or if you're trying to build in the evidence to fill in a picture. I think that in this intermediate area where it's more, is there the right combination between a insightful person and a compelling idea is where the private foundations often can work the best. And I think that that's also a very productive way to generate kind of the flashes of innovation that often lead to the big jumps in where we are in science.
If I think about the kinds of work that foundations have supported, at least in some cases, they're often working on the interface between the natural world and the world involving humans and human economies, because a lot of them are from major economic entities. And if I look at your own publications, your early work seems to have been more focused on basic physiology, leaf level physiology, and going to global scaling of these processes. But in the past few years, at least contemporaneous with your work with the IPCC, you've been publishing more on broader societal kinds of issues. Can you talk a little bit about how your interest and your thought processes may have developed from looking at the physiological work towards more of a consideration of society, environment, and the economy?
Well, one of the things I've learned, I guess it took me some decades to learn it, is that people are incredibly important parts of the way the Earth system works, and that you can't really claim to be doing global ecology without paying attention to the people, of the decisions they make, the reasons they make those decisions, and the implications of those decisions. And so one of the broad topics that I think of as being most exciting now is really understanding how humans interface with the environment, all the way from decisions that small-scale farmers make about whether to clear land or not, all the way up to national scale economic policies about encouraging mitigation or adaptation or both. And at this point, I would say that I'm primarily an admirer of the people who have the skills to do the real social science work, but I'm increasingly interested in decision-making science and the behavioral issues that lead to big decisions and changes in societies. I think especially as we look at changes to confront a changing climate, we really need to be able to understand what are the kind of decision points at which societies decide to go in different directions. What's the role of leadership? What's the role of technology? What's the role of policy? And how do those things fit together? And how can science best inform these decision-making and behavioral aspects?
If you think about the different ways that plants scale to biomes and then to global systems, and compare that to the way that individual humans scale to societies and governments and decision makers, it seems like there's very different ways that scaling might happen. In some sense, an ecosystem, a forest, functions as a collection of the individuals, individual leaves and stomata and chloroplasts, and are probably relatively amenable to scaling up processes. Whereas if you have a human system, the entities that are actually making the decision, the equivalent of national carbon sequestration, are not a linear or nonlinear collection of the individuals that make up that pinnacle of the decision-making process. And from your perspective, how are there any kind of commonalities in what you've learned from ecosystems and to the way trying to understand how decisions are actually made at the national level, theoretically representing the will or the collective desires of the populations?
There are lots of similarities between the way that large collections of humans do things like, consume energy and emit greenhouse gases, and the way that ecosystems do it. And there are lots of interesting and unexpected sources of nonlinearity or of breakpoints in both. I think that what I find fascinating about the human decision-making process is that, unlike in ecosystems, there really are tremendous opportunities for individual or a small number of actors to kind of change the direction of the way society goes. Innovation is really, really important. Making issues understandable and apparent is also an avenue where a few people can make a huge difference. So at least for me, I see both kinds of processes is interacting really, really richly, but working under mechanisms that are different on many, many respects. And at least the way I think about the Earth operating, one of the things I would like to know is that the human actors are as well informed about the ecosystem processes as possible, so they don't fall into the trap of making decisions that are based on misleading or incorrect information.
You did a recent interview with Carbon Brief, a UK-based organization, and talked quite a bit about your experience with the IPCC. And one theme that came up through that entire interview was the importance of what you're saying now, which is the importance of transparent, clear communication. If you look back at the history of the IPCC, pessimistic argument would be that in spite of many attempts to have good communication with governments and with broader society, not a great deal has changed about the way that society is consuming greenhouse or producing greenhouse gases and consuming fossil fuel resources. Do you think that there's significant hope for improvements on both ends in terms of societal willingness to accept or to engage with the scientific community, but also for the community itself to really change the way that they're trying to engage in communication?
Well, let me start by saying I think the IPCC has made amazing contributions to advancing not only our understanding, but public acceptance of the idea that climate change is real and that there are things we can do to address it. The thing to understand about the IPCC is because it's an intergovernmental process, every government in the world has agreed word by word that the statements in the summaries for policy represent the state of the science in terms of what we know and what we don't know. It's an incredibly important starting point for discussions. It's not the ending point for discussion. The slow progress on coming up with compelling approaches for decreasing emissions and for investing in adaptation really demonstrates why it's not comprehensive just to have an IPCC report. But it is a really important starting point. I'd love to see the IPCC in the future find ways to make this scientific foundation even more understandable and more compelling. But the most important thing is that there's a foundation that everybody agrees with. I think the hard thing about climate change is figuring out how we want to address the solutions and how to make the solutions fair. On the other hand, the really dramatic progress that's been made recently in terms of driving down the prices of renewable energy, the progress in energy efficiency, really points to a wide range of compelling solutions that have the opportunity to produce extensive co-benefits so that in solving the climate problem, we're also improving public health. We're improving international security. We're improving the access to energy. And I think that capitalizing on those co-benefits is going to be tremendously empowering in contrast to the earlier approach, which tended to say the solutions to this problem are going to essentially require a redistribution of wealth and sacrifices around the, especially the developed world. I think increasingly what we're seeing now are paths forward where what we're really talking about is innovations in the energy system that help us build stronger economies around the world. And we can use those stronger economies in order to make sure that we also are looking at vibrant communities and constructive individual-to-individual interaction.
So one part of the equation is clearly the co-benefits that arise from alternative energies. Another flip side of that is trying to recognize the negative externalities that arise out of things like massive coal consumption. And then that Drew Schindel has been working on this for a while and showing that if you properly account for the negative, principally public health consequences of coal consumption, that it ends up being vastly more expensive than is accounted for by the direct production and consumption costs. So they're kind of two ends of the same spectrum. One end of it is sort of trying to amp up the true cost of fossil fuel consumption, and the other is trying to better account for the benefits that arise out of alternative energy. Do you see one of those as being more fruitful and than the other, or should they both be going on simultaneously?
It's important that they both go simultaneously. We really are in, I think, the sunset of coal being an appropriate energy source. Coal powered the Industrial Revolution, tremendous number of benefits from it. But it's really clear now that coal is not a 21st century energy source. Incredibly dirty, probably more than 1 million people a year. Early deaths is associated with bad air quality from coal, particulates especially. We really have compelling alternatives. When you think about the costs of climate change that we would like to address, or the costs of the energy system that we would like to address by incorporating them in the price, some of them are the impacts, the future impacts of climate change. And certainly we can get a huge leveling of the playing field by just acknowledging that forcing of climate change is putting real costs on real people. Many of the air quality issues, especially from coal, represent a real cost to society that should be borne in an extra cost associated with using coal. And then it's also important to recognize that we live in a world where there are tremendous direct economic subsidies for fossil energy. Those subsidies probably amount to more than $500 billion a year globally. And if we ask how we could level the playing field in order to energize a transition to non-emitting energy sources, getting rid of subsidies, thinking about the co-benefits associated with decreased deaths from air pollution, and addressing the damages that are done by a changing climate, all represent big opportunities where renewables can really change the game, and where a level playing field would shift even more emphasis toward the opportunities that renewables present.
The cynical perspective on leveling the playing field is that entrenched fossil fuel interests have prevented that from taking place because of their vast lobbying power. Is there any element of truth to that from your point of view, or is it much a sort of a societal inertia that we've been doing this for so long? It's been part of our energy system since the Industrial Revolution, and it's just taking a long time to disengage from that process.
I think that both elements are true. The fossil energy companies are politically powerful, and they'd like to stay in business. And I think it also is true that we get tremendous benefits from access to energy, and access to cheaper energy provides a set of benefits that we don't want to overlook. I think the challenge moving forward is to find a way to have energy access from clean sources be the compelling choice. And I would love to see an environment in which fossil energy companies realize that there are opportunities for them to be part of the solution and not just a part of the problem. I admit that progress in that direction is slow, although it was really interesting that within just the last few weeks, we've seen 10 major international oil companies write to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and ask for systematic policies to address climate change, and recognizing that there need to be increasingly strong incentives to push fossil fuel emissions out of the system. Is looking forward, though, there are at least three roles for fossil energy companies moving forward. The first is that tomorrow we need oil and gas. We don't have replacements for a lot of the uses. And if we're going to continue to provide the energy services that the world demands, we're going to need oil and gas for some decades moving forward. I think the smart companies should be looking at ways that in decades in the future, they could be moving away from the pump and pollute model towards something that's much more sustainable. A second thing that's worth really emphasizing is that the oil and gas companies have a number of skills that are really, really important for the future. Some of these are skills in project management and setting up energy systems at vast international scale. Some speak to their core competencies, the competencies of drilling to geological formations that have precise characteristics that we want to use. But in the future, we may want to be utilizing those for carbon capture and storage rather than for extracting materials that we're going to release to the environment. So I think there are tremendous opportunities for the oil and gas companies to be transitioning to a model where they're actually making money on climate change solutions instead of creating the climate change problems. And then a third area that I think is going to be increasingly important is that we may continue to need hydrocarbons for a long time in the future, but the idea that those hydrocarbons come from material that was deposited hundreds of millions of years ago in deep geological formations may not be the way we get them at all. We may be making hydrocarbons synthetically from CO2 in the atmosphere and hydrogen or from carbon monoxide. I mean, there are a whole bunch of different processes from biomass where hydrocarbon production may continue to be a really big business where we have lots of opportunities for innovation, but we're just getting those materials from non-polluting sources. So in these three areas, continuing to meet the energy needs of the present and the near term, building on the core competencies of the fossil energy companies to help build solutions rather than problems, and also thinking about new ways to get hydrocarbons, all represent, I think, possibilities for energy companies to stay in the mix, to be increasingly forces for solving the problem rather than for exacerbating the problem.
You're here in Silicon Valley, where probably the most innovative work is going on in terms of alternative energy. What do you see coming down the pipeline in the next 5 to 10 years in this ability to fix hydrocarbons ourselves and remove it from the geological past?
Well, you know, I think that we are seeing amazing progress on both traditional and very innovative approaches to renewable energy. It's striking now that the costs for wind and solar are close to competitive with costs for coal or natural gas, and in some places are even cheaper. And I think what we are seeing is increasingly what had been the big bugaboo in renewable energy, the question of intermittency, is closer and closer to solution.
How is that being resolved?
Oh, with a whole bunch of strategies, just the way that almost everything in the energy system is. So a better grid integration, a better demand side management, a better application of storage options, including batteries and flywheels, thinking about utilizing electrified transportation as a way to balance loads across the grid, and increasingly with chemical fuels. And you know, I'm very excited about the prospects for using light energy, either as electricity or as sunlight directly, in order to generate chemical fuels, or whether they're hydrogen or hydrocarbons is still in flux. But it looks to me like generating chemical fuels from sunlight is going to be a big, important part of the energy system moving forward. And it's one of the areas that I consider most exciting. But I also want to emphasize that there were exciting developments across the spectrum, including many technologies that are ready to go today. And I think the real core that we need to be working on is deploying the existing technologies as aggressively as possible at the same time that we bring the new technologies on stream. Lots of the financial instruments that make it attractive to invest in fossil don't yet work for renewables. And that's another feature that's actually distorting the playing field toward fossil.
I was curious about that exact question, because it seems like this huge opportunity for investing in renewables, but that capitalism as a whole has been fairly stupid about that and hasn't at all adjusted their incentive structure to take advantage of that. And then what you're saying there is that it's going to require a fairly substantial revision of the way that the equation is approached.
It's not so much a substantial revision as some small adjustments. You know, a very large fraction of the financial capital that's out there is in things like endowments and pension funds, institutions that are primarily long-term investors and are also oriented toward building a better world. So there's not a fundamental inconsistency between their objectives and investment in renewables. What they need is technical financial environments in which investments in renewables can be expected to pay a reasonable return based on their genuine economic prospects and not one that's distorted by the financial instruments.
So one interesting effort that's partially in that area is Al Gore's investment fund. He and other partners called Generations, and they're not having an explicitly or solely a goal to invest in energy-based companies or green energy or alternative energy, but trying to take a much broader viewpoint on the overall incentive structure for investing. So taking into account how executives are compensated, looking more towards a longer-term viewpoint, and then coming at the idea of whether or not to invest in current fossil fuel companies from a purely rationalist, let's make as much money as possible point of view. And then from that, making the decision that they should not invest in traditional energy companies because of the fact that so many of their assets are going to be determined to be societally unusable. Now, that's their take on it. Do you think that that kind of approach to investing and analysis is gaining any kind of a broader foothold?
If you say what have been the market returns on investment in fossil over the last couple of years, it's been terrible investments in general, mainly as a consequence of the way that the international prices on coal, oil, and gas have changed. You know, I think that the real challenge is how to orient investors away from quarter-by-quarter returns toward longer-term returns. And some of those represent kind of decisions that can be made on the basis of individuals making investments through vehicles who are available in the market now, and some can't. And I think that part of the reason that we need to look at the financial environment is to ask, you know, do we want to be in a world where we're implicitly encouraging short-run thinking and short-run market variables in as determining the investment decisions that people and institutions make, or do we want to shift over toward a longer-term perspective? And I think that's where making sure that the financial vehicles, the kind of investments that are legal and are encouraged, are consistent with the balance that we as a society want between shorter-term and longer-term goals.
Thinking again about the economic issues and the recent elections for the IPCC chair, the previous candidates, and there were six of them, you were one of them, and Thomas Stocker was another one of them, sort of coming from the Working Group 1 and Working Group 2 backgrounds from AR5. And then the person who was elected was an economist. Do you think that's any kind of a statement from the representatives of the world governments that they're becoming more interested in the economic perspective and ways of approaching the economics of it and less interested in the Working Group 1 and Working Group 2 perspectives, or are they totally separate issues?
It's really hard to know what drove the dynamics of the recent IPCC elections. You know, Working Group 2 and Working Group 3 are both deeply focused on solutions to the climate problem, with Working Group 2 covering adaptations and Working Group 3 covering mitigations. And it's really clear that human decisions and decisions about investments play out in both of those. I do think that pretty much all of the discussion in the IPCC and all of the candidates recognize that in the scientific community, we need to be transitioning more from understanding what you might think of as the problem space of climate change to understanding the solution space. But I think it's also clear that the solution space is really rich, and it doesn't just involve financial levers.
I'm sure you come into discussions at Stanford and in the nonprofit communities that you're working with about the relative investment in things like HIV, AIDS, or conflict reduction versus the sort of longer term, more existential threats from climate change. Of course, some of which are becoming more proximate with the changes in extremes and sea level rise. But what is your own personal take on the need for societies to invest in the immediate problems that are caused by, let's say, earthquakes, for example, tsunamis, and then epidemiology and conflicts relative to the kinds of impacts that could be much more severe, but over a longer term period from climate change?
I think what we need is a smart portfolio that's got a balance of interest between the shorter term and the longer term goals. And in particular, when we think about the near-term investments, we ought to be thinking about steps that address multiple challenges with single kinds of investments. And so when we look at adapting to a wide range of risks, not only from a changing climate, but from, you know, civil conflict or from various kinds of disruptions of the economic system, things like assuring that we have a good transportation network, good communications network, solid investments in public health, those pay off no matter what you're doing. Similarly, when we look at transitions in the energy system, the energy efficiency pays off no matter what you do, no matter what your goals are. And there are strong motivations for thinking hard about energy efficiency. There's strong motivations for moving away from coal, because we're talking about transportation issues, we're talking about public health issues, we're talking about climate change issues. And whenever we can make a single investment that moves us forward on two or three different agendas, it's going to be easier to justify than one that only addresses a single agenda.
Chris Field from the Carnegie Institute for Global Ecology and Stanford University. It's always great to talk to a climate scientist who is feeling at least a little bit optimistic.
Good to talk with you, Michael. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.